Go, je commence. Merci beaucoup à Laurent pour l'organisation de cette colloque, pour l'invitation mais présent. Je suis désolé, mais cette présentation est c'est anglais.
Une vengeance.
With a slightly different title than the program, but that's just an aspect of how human beings change their mind about things over time. I'm going to look at some issues in the preservation of computer music, with a particular focus on the Super Collider audio programming language with which I'm quite involved in development. So I want to look at the context of maintenance, the challenges in particular for Super Collider, and some specific case studies, not just from my own experience, but also from some Super Collider users who I've been surveying in the last few weeks. Why do we change at all? There are inexorable commercial pressures to do so. The competition between companies, the desire to keep revenue streams. There's an inexorable artistic pressure, which kindly might be called curiosity, but we could say just as well that it was competition. It might be nice to have a moratorium on progress. Miguel de Pedro, Kid 606, noted, by the time you've learned how to use something, there's already something else. I would love for everything to just pause right now. No new advances, no faster computers, no new Macs, and then we'll see what we can do for the next 2 years. He said this in 2002, and it didn't have any effect. Things kept moving. There is a solution, the improviser's solution. Don't preserve anything. Let things be of the moment. Irrevocable change is good. Design cycles are not real-time constructions. So here's an example. In live coding, which is usually a bit controversial, we reprogram the computer during the concert. You can change your mind at any point. You may start from a blank screen and try to perform. Increasingly, there are aspects of performance art here, certainly highly improvised. It's taken place, well, in an offline sense in studios, but in concert halls, planetariums. There's a planetarium. These are just little example pictures. They're strange in a way because here's some documentation, some images of some performances, but I'm not giving you audio. You really had to be there. You won't really understand why this teddy bear has been dismembered if you weren't at that particular gig, and I'm not going to explain it any further to you. There's a serious side, there's algorithmic choreography, where we sculpt actions in real time and change our mind about what people have to do. It doesn't have to involve computers at all, which is interesting in the sense of digital preservation. Are there ways to preserve certain ideas affiliated with digital content? For example, the use of algorithms, without necessarily being reliant upon computers, so that if we lost the electricity, we could still enact certain sorts of algorithmic art. So rewriting the rule book of rule-based art is essentially what it's all about. There are insights into the psychology of programming, into musical activity. There's the idea of conceptual level preservation, which I'll come back to, and which has also been raised so far today, I think, in terms of higher level structures for the preservation of a piece. Okay, but that aside, leaving improvisation, assuming we've developed a lot of, we've invested a lot of time in developing systems, what are the best survival strategies, right? And I'm now going to think about not just surviving for 3 years, which is about the life cycle of a single computer, but surviving 300 years. So Frederick Collison said, what we should do is work our pieces into the genetic code of the cockroach. That's a good way to survive a nuclear holocaust. We need to create institutions dedicated to preserving pieces for a long, long time. You may know of Jem Feiner's work, Long Player, which has been playing now since 2000, so it's been playing for 11 years. You may know of the Long Now Foundation, set up to promote long-term thinking. In particular, they have this project to make a clock that will last for a millennium, and they try to make it out of materials that aren't too precious, so they don't get cannibalized, and to make it simple enough that it can be maintained in the face of changing knowledge. We often find ourselves, in terms of generative music, making works that are potentially infinite. Though we might like to take this from the mathematician's point of view, which is that we can reason about infinite spaces without necessarily having to enumerate computably every point in that space. So perhaps it's not enough to appreciate that something is potentially infinite without having to preserve it longer than a short time. But I've written about this stuff before, so I'm going to move on. Let's get more practical. So now we're going to start to think about surviving for a few years rather than surviving for 1,000 years. And I want to look in particular at SuperCollider, which is an open source, free audio programming language that I've done a lot of work in and many other people have invested their time in. There have been 3 major versions, which already shows you that this project is not immune to change. The first version, released by James McCartney in 1996, a second version in 1998, which was totally incompatible with the first version, and a third version, released in 2002 and open-sourced, which is almost totally incompatible with the second version. Okay. So it's an open-source project, it is free, and the source code is all available, which gives it a sort of an inbuilt advantage against certain commercial environments. But there's a small dedicated development team who, of course, are unpaid, which is perhaps a disadvantage. Contributions are sometimes ad hoc. Often it's a duocracy in terms of what gets maintained, what gets changed. The person who makes the change is the one who sometimes wins. And so, of course, there are maintenance issues. We have to support lots of different platforms, so any change in any one platform can impact on the whole program. Historically, it's been a Mac-based program. It is now fully cross-platform, but we have less active Windows developers. So it's much more actively maintained for Mac or Linux. We have platform-specific code floating around. There are various GUI systems. One of them only works on the Mac. Another one is cross-platform because it's based on Java. But you have to deal with supporting these two systems. And we continually chase operating system updates. So one current issue is that on OS X, we're supporting 10.4 to 10.6. We have to decide at what point do we stop supporting 10.4. You end up at the moment with situations where you make these fat universal binaries. You've got to support 32-bit, 64-bit, PowerPC, Intel. So there's too many machines around to support. At some point, the developers will just not be able to cope anymore and will say, right, we no longer support a certain older system. So as it's changed over time, this should say SC2 to SC3. Transition from something to itself isn't quite so spectacular, meant a lot of compositions had to be abandoned in 2002, or converted at great expense of time. Another big switch was from PowerPC to Intel on Macs, It caused some subtle changes and it broke some things. For example, the PowerPC used to deal with dividing by zero much better than the Intel machines do, which had an impact on low-level digital signal processing code, because at certain points people make assumptions. They assume that it will be okay if you divide by zero. So what used to work suddenly doesn't work when you switch the chip. And we have a constant tug of war in development between backwards compatibility, between making sure that code that ran in 2002 still works, and rationalization or efficiency or new features. So the desire to tidy things up, to make things run faster, which often means making them more specialized to a particular kind of machine, which means you support less well older machines, or new features, which are the classic way to break old features. So to give you some examples, last weekend I updated to the bleeding edge of SuperCollider in terms of its code base. I immediately found that what used to be a way of writing definitions for sound synthesis had been deprecated. So now, every time you use this memstore method, I don't really expect you, by the way, to understand the SuperCollider language if you're not familiar with it, but I'm just saying this issue exists. If I use the memstore method, a message would appear saying this has been deprecated. Okay? Now that's a decision that developers take because they think, well, that old way is a bad way of doing things. We want to enforce a new behavior that we think is more rational. But it immediately knocks out pieces that had different assumptions that were made at an earlier point in time.
Is it just a change of name or a parameter?
Yeah, it's essentially a change of name.
Okay, so then you can...
There's one good reason for it, which is that beginners got very confused by the term.
Yes.
But they were getting confused by the term for quite a few years. So there was quite a few pieces made predicated on that term. So we've moved from memstore to add, and add is a bit easier, a term for the beginners. But there are issues just in that sort of change. And there was a nasty one as well. A tiny change, it's one line of C code, taken out of a particular base class, meant that all old plugins, then crashed. The change was made for efficiency reasons, to avoid allocating one pointer worth of memory per plugin.
To avoid allocating?
Allocating one pointer worth of memory per plugin. So about, 4 to 8 bytes per plugin.
Mm.
So of course that led to a big battle, a development to and fro. Should we be backwards compatible and not break all the old plugins, or should we have this change, which would make things very, very, very slightly more efficient? And eventually, backwards compatibility won out. I have to say that I fought for this, so perhaps it shows that personally I'm a little sympathetic to the issues of backwards compatibility. We put the pointer back in, but we just renamed it and called it extensions. And so if we need to change this struct again in the future, we have a place where we can both build forwards, but we're still backwards compatible to the past. Okay, that's the most complicated code I'll show today. That's just some C code from low down. But it just shows an example of how specific some of these issues get. Here's a more fun example. This is from Fredrik Olofsson again, Swedish composer. He wrote some SuperCollider code. Again, you don't have to bother to read it, but it's just that bit of code there. And it was a nice little noise piece. What it did was it deliberately blew up a high-pass filter. And on older machines, this was fine. In actual fact, it made nice sounds when it blew up the filter. On newer machines, it turned out that Apple had added a new software limiter that doesn't cope very well with bad number values coming through. And in fact, the sound card blows up. It kind of goes... Okay. So what we have now is a piece, a short piece, here's a composition, which sounds different on different machines. So I'm going to try and show this to you. It's a noise piece, so it's not going to be pretty. It might be interesting. I'll turn it down slightly before I run it. I know, I'll just run it from here. So here's the old version. It's the same code, but just caused by change of chip, or change of... So you can hear these sort of limiter problems, essentially. And that wasn't caused by changes in SuperGlider, that's caused by just Apple making decisions about how they deal with and call audio on the machine. Okay, so I thought it shouldn't really just be me standing here and giving examples. I would poll the SuperGlider mailing list for users' opinions on these issues of preservation. I thought you might be interested to hear from them. So I carried out a very informal survey on mailing lists. Range of views. The issues probably energised longer-term users more, which is, I guess, what you would expect, because these are the people who've fallen over in the past because of these issues of preservation. New users aren't really experienced enough to worry. They're blindly making pieces and not really thinking too far ahead about what will happen if the system itself changes. Just to give you a little sanity check, of course there were the opinions that I presented earlier of let's not preserve anything. So for example, for Magnuson and Vixie Software said, let the old stuff rot. This is digital media's way of filtering out rubbish. Things are good in their time when they're relevant, and then they become obsolete. Do you think future generations would be as obsessed with archiving as we are? I thought you would like that as a sanity check. But of course not everybody said that. So, one issue that came up was the issue of preserving code on a day-to-day basis. And it turned out that it wasn't just a particular version of the SuperGlider application that mattered, or a particular piece in terms of its own code. It was also the third-party extensions, and also the particular version of the operating system, the particular machine itself. Users were concerned about remaining organized enough to keep track of this stuff. Miguel Negrao said, I guess I should be more organized and keep track of these things, the implication being that a few years down the line, he hasn't really documented things enough to be able to get back the piece as he's constructed it. Chris Sattinger suggested that we really should be adopting models from languages like Python. I don't know if you know Python. I don't know this particular stuff very well, but apparently there's this virtual env or build-out modes where you can encapsulate on your machine the particular version of Python, your program, and also all module extensions that are relevant to your piece at that moment in time. And it will make an archived version for you that's a lot more future-proof, supposedly. We do have one sort of thing in SuperGlider. There is a standalone facility. So you can make a package single bundle. A bit like with Macs, you'd make a single standalone with Macs. But it's OSX only, so it doesn't work for people on Linux or doesn't work for people on Windows. Okay. Fabrice Maggini, a French composer now based in Italy, said, It took me a long time to adjust to the language changes from OS9 to OSX, and I lost many compositions written in old code. This was the shift from SuperCollider 2 to SuperCollider 3. It doesn't matter, because we change as well. We may use this opportunity to work on fresh ideas. But I realised, for instance, that the high number of nested spawns I was using in SuperCollider 2, just an old scheduling mechanism in SuperCollider 2, was giving very satisfying musical results at the time. So I guess all the limitations we may have at any time, speed, language, are a challenge and platform for creativity. And we can just do sounding great stuff at any stage. So quite a pragmatic view, really, considering that he may be smarting inside that he lost a lot of pieces from the transition. Josh Parmenter, American composer, said, "Porting works from SE2 to SE3 is something I hope to never have to do again." This is somebody who really spent hours converting old interactive electroacoustic works from SuperCollider 2 to a newer version. Now, he had some interesting experiences there. He said, "Now he's trying to document works the best I can." He's also been working with other composers to document their works. And I'm not sure if you're aware of this. I wasn't until he told me. But Richard Carpen's piece, Aperture, from 2006, there's a website dedicated to this piece where they've preserved not only footage from the concert, but also, and I'll show you an example, full documentation of the piece itself at a relatively high level, with example realization scores and all sorts of precise details about what must take place at each point in the piece. Reminds me in part, I don't know if you also know Barry Truax's work in documentation, where as he's created fixed electroacoustic works, he's made extensive HTML site sort of documentation of the whole of all processes. But this is an example for an interactive piece. So it might be, if you're interested, it might be worth a look at Richard Carpen's Aperture. And Josh said, "I can honestly say, if I was offered the trade-off of having a sustainable model that I could work in and know my work would survive into the next century, but I had to give up recording technology, I would take the first in a second." And this was the idea, really, that the score had actually served well as a transmission mechanism. But perhaps there's no, there really isn't, any universal score fit for electronics. But if we could work towards something that was a bit more accepted, Josh would be very happy to swap to that as his main way of preserving pieces. So this is someone who's really truly suffered in terms of updating his works, but who would be willing to trust a new documentation standard if one could be agreed. And there's the real problem, because we're all so individualistic. Andrew Violet in Italy discussed autography versus allography, writing something in with your own hand or letting somebody else write near your style. Write your words themselves. So these issues of if you had documentation but you had to rebuild the piece, it's not really autography, it's allography. He discussed again these issues of documentation. I don't know if you've seen a recent Computer Music Journal article, but he was involved in the project where they reconstructed Poème Électronique. And what he found in doing that, they had access both to original materials, the audio recordings themselves, pictures from the projections, and they also had access to composers' notes. And they found the scripts, the composers' notes, much easier to work with than the original materials. Because the original materials, I think in many cases, didn't give enough information. They had stills from the projections, but they weren't sure quite how to project onto different surfaces. If you know the project, they were trying to do a spatial, both sonic and visual reconstruction of the pavilion, of the interior. And he contrasted Centro Tempo Real in Italy, their work on high-level notation systems, so they, for pieces, I think for various pieces amongst others, they release these high-level specifications, score-like specifications, rather than any exact code. He contrasted that with EARCAM, who often, in his experience, were releasing old max patches that, in some occasions, weren't really working well. Examples of Jonathan Harvey's works he gave in concert, where the old max patches got locked down and weren't quite working as they should. And then Mariah actually had more problems with her hardware work than with software work. So I'm not sure all my homemade performance interfaces and analog electronic components still work, and that may be harder to fix than the code itself. She's done a lot of work with sensor control performances, including with dance companies. But again, she was quite pragmatic. For the majority of these pieces, I consider them as studies in my artistic development, and as such have no wish to perform them again as I've moved on or developed techniques further. I think this issue was also mentioned over lunch, that many composers found that they, 25 years on, they changed themselves so much that their original work didn't feel so close to themselves anymore. But she has a lot of experience. She spent 5 years creating collaborative dance theatre pieces. And she's discussed this balance between adapting to specific ideas in rehearsal, where you have to quickly adapt to suggestions of the choreographer, suggestions of the composer, suggestions from the creative team, and also the need to make reusable code so that you're a bit more future-proof. So there's a tension between quick, specific hacks just to make the performance work and the desire to have better code maintenance built in. Okay. And since many of her collaborators aren't so concerned about long-term maintenance, that impacts on her ability to maintain works over time. Okay. So I just wanted to give you some voices from the SuperCollider community, to give you a wider range of examples than my own.
These are essentially composers. No performer in reply, or
because it's a mixture.
The point of view from the composer and the performer might be different.
Many of them are performers in the sense of
their own work, probably.
They don't just work in the notational side of composition. Mm-hmm. Often they're laptop performers or they're. There's probably more composers who responded than others. Mariah, I thought, was interesting because she was working as a facilitator, mm-hmm. as much as anything else. Just solely from the performer's point of view, no, there are a few respondents. I can't think of respondents for that. Yeah.
She was in Saint-Etienne last year for another collection about the specialization. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so in terms of my own tools, just to say briefly how I found maintaining stuff over time. I built quite a few interactive music systems around 2006 when I was doing my doctoral thesis. They don't work anymore. But I did recently have to rebuild one, and it only really took about an evening. So it wasn't a massive hit of time to update. The actual rebuilding was mainly fixing the plugin, fixing the sort of custom DSP code, which again is sort of related to these machine issues of the chips changing very slightly. And just recompiling for current machines, current architectures. So it wasn't quite as much work as I feared. But we're talking about something that's only 4 years ago, so. Mm.
The plugins were in C, or
So
it was just, and it was your own code or open source? So
it was my own code built on open source.
Okay, so it was essentially a matter of recompiling and changing. Yeah.
So I didn't have to reinterpret my own self. Now going back slightly further, I've been developing a system called BBcast since about 2001. I no longer actively support it. Strangely though, it still does work. But that's just luck. Okay? Essentially, certain core parts of SuperCollider haven't changed enough to break this system. But one day, and probably a day quite soon, it will be irrevocably broken. And I've already publicly stated I don't support it anymore. What I've worked on a lot is new sound synthesis algorithms or new machine listening algorithms. And a lot of the work has actually found its way into the core of SuperCollider or into a sort of adjunct to SuperCollider called SC3 plugins. And here, there have been third parties, not myself, other developers who've gone in and made fixes to that code. So in some sense, that's helpful. That means that I'm not totally responsible for everything. On the other hand, in this duocracy, the primary responsibility is essentially mine because I proposed that stuff in the first place. And you're often torn between the desire to have backwards compatibility, to make sure that exactly the same new gen runs, and there's a desire essentially to rewrite it, because you yourself, as a coder, not just as a composer, but as a coder, change over the years and are insulted by your own old code. It's also a bit of a strain in terms of the duty of care, because if you're a computer music researcher, as I'm sure we all are active in this way, you're often working on new projects. And so you hate to be distracted to go back to old projects to fix them. The drive in academia is to keep researching new things. Okay, so I do another practical example. Fixing a plugin can destroy old sounds. So if you update something for safety, I've shown you already with a change to the operating system can impact. But now if you update something for safety, that can also impact on timbre. So I've created plugins in the past which turned out to have errors, but had been released for long enough that people had started to use them. And in this case, you have to choose whether to change the sound to fix the theory or to make a new version. So just to give you a quick example, I'll run some actual SuperCollider for you. If this works. This is a nonlinear sound synthesis algorithm based on just modeling Newtonian gravity. And it turned out that my model of gravity in the first version was wrong. Okay? So I've just essentially just miscoded it. It wasn't really a theory of Newtonian gravity, despite the claims. And yet people had made a few sounds with it, and I didn't feel I could destroy the sounds. And so what I'm going to play you is, first I'm going to play you a theory of gravity that's wrong, and then I'm going to play you a second plugin which has the correct theory of gravity, but probably doesn't sound as good. I hope I am. Quick sound check. Right. Must be my fault somehow. For example, two. Thank you. sort of a noisy plugin, really, a sort of non-standard sound synthesis generator. That was the correct theory of gravity, and now the incorrect. Which does these sort of big aliased bursts of noise, but people sort of liked that. So there was a contrast between theoretical purity and just the sheer listening result.
What was the difference?
The difference was that I'd got the fall off of gravity wrong. So I think it might even have been a reciprocal somewhere. I hadn't taken the reciprocal when I was supposed to, or I think it was an issue of just simple maths error. And just to show the efforts of maintaining stuff, here's my own dilemma with changes in SuperCollider. This is an old live coding system from SuperCollider 2, back from about 2002. And soon after it was built, SuperCollider 3 came along, which broke it totally. You just cannot update it. So then it takes weeks of work to get one that does work. Maybe for reasons of time I won't run it. If you'll believe me, I'll tell you that I do have something that's a bit like this, but just looks different, but is essentially the same sort of ideas for SuperCollider 3. I'll move on, because we've got so much time. Skip that. Okay, anyway, in right now, I'm wanting to release for more than one platform. So I realise that just being locked to one platform can be unhealthy. So I want to actually release stuff for SuperCollider and Max MSP. But that leads to its own issues. So you can write common code for the main DSP, and then you try and just write a small wrapper for your common code set. But in actual fact, SuperCollider and Max, in terms of writing an external for Max and writing a plugin for SuperCollider, have different assumptions about memory management. And you end up having not as small a wrapper as you hoped, essentially. You end up having to make very program-specific code in your wrapper that can actually get quite elaborate. Now, I could show you an example, but I'm just thinking, again, for reasons of time, maybe you'll just believe me here. But let's just say that in SuperCollider, you can instantiate any plugin at any moment in time dynamically, which means that your memory allocation has to fit real-time constraints, whereas in Max, you just press the DSP button, and that's the point at which your externals get created, and it's slightly smoother over the memory handling them. It's a bit easier. So I have built examples of plugins that run on both systems, but it can be fiddly. Skip that. So there's this temptation to just even leave SuperCollider, leave Maximum Speed, and just write everything in C. I used to write things purely in C, and then I found SuperCollider and found that it could help me get to certain places in research more quickly. But now I find myself returning to pure C again, thinking that it maybe is, after all, slightly more future-proof. It certainly sort of gets you out of any worries about licensing issues. And this is perhaps, we should call it Robert Rowe's model. I don't know if you know about Robert Rowe's work, but he has tended to write things just in vanilla C++. And when he releases a work to a performer, it's a pre-built application, but built using entirely his own C++, so he's not dependent on third-party libraries, so he's pretty sure that he can just compile it for different platforms and just run it. All that you need to do is just make sure that you can access the audio driver on a particular machine. And I quite like that model. However, there's the distraction of other platforms. So there's this fun thing around the iPhone, It's a great source of controllers. Does this multi-touch stuff. Probably soon be obsolete, though. I mean, give it 5 years. I've written apps for it. Because I'm sad to do a talk without enough audio in it. I'll play you some noises. I'll play you noises from one that's been open sourced. So this is, if you are curious about this particular iPhone app, you can actually get the source code as well as the app from the App Store. It's free from the App Store. This is a live coding app. So it's a way of sneaking an interpreter onto a... onto the iPhone, iPod Touch in this case. See if I can get it to work. So there's a sort of language of symbols. Change the program as you go. Okay. So that's a fun thing, and the fun thing about doing these apps is that they probably reach many more people. So rather than getting 50 downloads, you get 5,000. Having said that, the problem is you get locked into quite a proprietary platform. So then you get these further dilemmas. I've just had to renew the developer license, so even just to keep stuff available, you have to pay money each year. It's really different to the open source thing. I'm not really mad about paying every year from here on in, so what do? Do I go to Android? We know that mobiles are massively popular, that there are 3 billion mobiles and only 1 billion computers, so it's a much bigger target market if you're serious about making musical content creation devices available to lots of people. So there's all sorts of real maintenance issues here about closed source rather than open source. So we could come back to the point at the beginning. Perhaps preservation is not compatible with such a high speed of technological shift. Perhaps composers should not consider themselves as too privileged, but just one amongst billions of human creators. Won't future media archaeologists be busy with their own work? I don't know, perhaps they could on a Friday help to preserve works from the past. On the other hand, what perhaps has been discussed a bit today, and what I saw in comments from the SuperCloudy users, was that preservation is perhaps more robust by a higher level description, that you return to specification when remaking works, and you don't necessarily rely upon those low level, nitty gritty details. There is a recognition, I think, of recordings as an essential adjunct, despite Josh Pimenta saying that he'd give up on recordings if he could have this high level specification. It's just that sometimes the devil is in the details. So, if I wanted to preserve this Toplap app, it has a certain way of creating the sound that's intimately tied to the user interface, that you're dealing with these very low-level instructions for how sound will be compiled, essentially, live on that device. And so if I want to preserve that, I've got some quite low-level stuff that I have to keep hold of. Okay, so I think I'm done. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
I don't know if there are questions, comments.
So are you part of this Toplap group? Live coding?
I guess I've been associated.
Okay.
Usually under a Swedish alias.
Okay.
Je propose qu'on prenne une petite pause de 5 minutes pour installer les deux dernières interventions et s'entraîner trop parce qu'on est un petit peu en retard.